Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Charlene Aiken, bar number 35396, and I represent Edward Tyler, Kimberly Tyler James, and Leadership Preparatory Academy in this case. This is a case about the winding up and closing down of one of the best schools in the district. And the issue that I would like to focus on today deals with our damages component of the argument. And that is the conversion claim, the money had and received claim, the duplicate breach of contract damages, and the total damages award versus the claimed amount of damages. On the conversion claim, there was a legal dispute that existed, whether the district or LPA had the right to control the property at the time of revocation. There was a legal question of ownership here that should have been decided. There was a failure on the trial court to make a legal determination on who had the right to control the property, who had the superior right of possession of LPA's accounts. And it was—
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Aiken, but didn't the trial court make a determination of that on summary judgment?
No, Your Honor. The court made a determination that LPA had breached the contract when it was interpreting it as far as the assets of the physical personal property, not the LPA's accounts. And in addition,
I made a determination of law that LPA was required to turn it over as soon as their charter was pulled.
There was a determination in a preliminary injunction that they were to turn over the assets, which was the physical property, the curriculum, the books, the furniture. There was never any discussion or any determination made at that time or prior to trial that dealt with who had the right to control the money in LPA's accounts, the intangible property, at the time of revocation.
Ms. Aiken, how is money not an asset?
Money is not an asset here because this deals with, first of all, the summary judgment that was made, and I think I should make that clear for Judge Terry's question, is that was a breach of contract as it relates to LPA. These conversion and money had and received claims are an individual claim brought against the Tylers. Now, the personal property is not an asset because that was intangible, and it was something that the preliminary injunction and the orders, it did not speak to, it did not identify in any way assets being the bank account, the money in the account. So you cannot make that assumption that returning the chalkboards means also giving authorization over to the accounts or turning over the grant money that was in LPA's foundation account. That's not a likely assumption. It should not be implied that the order spoke to the money in those accounts.
I'm not following. If the money belongs to LPA, how is it any less of an asset of LPA than a chalkboard?
If the money does belong to LPA?
Yes.
If the money—
If it's an LPA account.
Right.
And it grant money, for example.
Right.
I just gave the example.
Right.
How does that not belong to LPA?
The money does belong to LPA.
So how is it not an asset, just as a chalkboard is an asset?
Well, the chalkboard is an asset, but I think that the court needed to make a legal determination. There was a legal question here that was different than the assets and the return of the physical property. And if we look at the contract, the court, the contract is ambiguous, saying that the district has the authority to conduct the winding up of the business and the affairs of LPA. Well, does that include just the personal property? Does that include the personal property plus all the money in the accounts? That determination was never made.
Well, Ms. Aiken, how could the business be wound up without taking account of the money that LPA owned? How could that happen? You'd have to have an accounting of assets and liabilities and distributions. How can that be done without the money?
I think because when we go back to the preliminary injunction and when we go back to the circumstances surrounding the revocation, There was an appeal process going on here, and the LPA had the right to appeal the revocation that happened, and they were doing that, and they did submit that to the Board of Education. And even in the preliminary injunction stage, the judge stated that the assets will be turned over to the district. However, they will be preserved to the extent they can be preserved in case the revocation is found to be overturned. And so it was preserving the assets. And I think that winding up and conducting of the affairs, that the court failed to make that determination either in the preliminary injunction or before trial, that included turning over the accounts. And if that determination would have been made, then that would have been, okay, the district has the right to control that money based on this contract, based on winding up of the affairs. That obviously includes the district having control. That determination was never made. So it's improper for the trial court then to submit that question to the jury on who has the right to control possession of that property at the time.
Counsel, let me just ask you a couple questions about that. Implicit in your observation that the district court didn't make that determination is, I guess, the assertion that you asked the court to make that determination and it refused to do so?
I don't believe that trial counsel did. Well, actually, Your Honor, there was a summary judgment about 4 months before trial, and that was a defendant's motion. However, the damages that we were talking about 4 months before trial dealt with post-revocation salaries only and the pre-revocation American Express charges. So the actual damages that the Tylers were found liable for under both conversion and money had to receive dealt with the pre-revocation bills and accounts payable that was paid from post-revocation to the time of the State Board of Education decision. And those damages were not brought to the forefront until a couple days before trial. So even at that summary judgment stage, and which was denied by the trial court saying that was disputed issues of fact to bring conversion and money had to receive, we weren't dealing with the same type of damages that we are now today.
So do I discern that the answer is no, that no one ever asked the court to make this determination?
That is correct.
Okay, so what effect does that have on your claim now?
I believe that here we are asking for to vacate the damages because, first of all, there was no showing of superior right to possession. As to the conversion, it would be the right to control, and as to the money had and received, it would be the funds spent for appropriate uses of LPA, so no basis in equity that it ought to be returned. However, in the alternative, we ask that this court would reverse the judgment and remand to the trial court for determination that there were legal questions that pertain to conversion that need to be determined.
If these are questions of law, could we make the determination for the first time on appeal?
Correct. If the court does look to the contract and make a contract interpretation, that's a de novo standard, and definitely the court could make that determination here. I just wanted to move on to the punitive damages aspect of the conversion. Here, a punitive damages is cannot be sustained when it's under an erroneous claim of right and over the protest of its possessor. And we have definitely an erroneous claim of right because we have a legal dispute about who has the right to control this property. And in addition, we're missing that knowledge component of a willful and wanton conduct. And second of all, if we compare the fact that punitive damages was assessed on the conversion claim, which is your, if you're looking at your money claims, that money had and received in your conversion and your civil theft being your highest burden of proof, they were not found liable under your civil theft, which requires knowingly obtains or exercises control over anything of value of another without authorization by threat or deception. So if you compare that conduct being non-liability versus still finding some willful and wanton conduct, I think that the punitive damages was erroneously submitted to the jury without that legal question submitted or determined, excuse me. On the money had and received claim, there are two aspects to the money had and received claim. First, there's a post-revocation transfers, and there's also the American Express expenditures. And all of these American Express expenditures were pre-revocation. The post-revocation transfers is similar to our conversion argument that there was a legal error because there was no determination as a right to control. But on the American Express charges, there's a dispute, clearly conflicting evidence between what is appropriate and what is inappropriate charges. However, Joseph Royer, who put together the damage analysis for the American Express charges, he did admit that these damages were speculative. He admitted he was not familiar with some of the vendors of LPA. He admitted that airfare was based on his speculation because he wasn't sure if it was school-related charges. And damages cannot be speculative. It was legal error to award these speculative damages, so this must be overturned. I'd like to also touch briefly on the duplicate breach of contract damages. As you know, the breach of contract was simply against LPA, and there was about $36,000 that was spent on school supplies and equipment after revocation to continue school in August. And this money came from a $90,000 PPR funds that LPA was to receive on the date of revocation, but instead the district withheld because it did revoke its charter.
Pardon me for just a moment. There's no explanation in your brief of what PPR stands for. What is it?
It's per pupil revenue, and it's based on how many students are in the school.
Thank you.
And so this $90,000, this is the money that the district used to buy supplies, the same money that LPA would have used to buy the supplies. So there's no damages here that are making the district whole. This is not $36,000 spent on top of the $90,000. This is the money that they used from the $90,000. There's no compensatory damages which have put the wrong party in position who would have been if the breach wouldn't have happened. And lastly, I'd like to touch upon the claimed damages versus the damages that were actually awarded. And I think that we have a judicial admission here in closing argument. As stated on page 38 of our reply brief and page 45 of the answer brief, if I may read counsel's statement, he is talking about post-revocation damages, which is reflected on Exhibit 48, and he states, the $227,840 that was taken from LPA's account, Mr. Royer testified that $48,419 of that would have been spent anyway, in his opinion, by the district to wrap up the affairs of the charter school. We're not claiming that money. So $50,000 of that, we're not claiming that money. That leaves about $180,000 left. And then he went on to explain how the damages should be assessed amongst the multiple parties. So if we take the amount that was actually awarded, which was $218,500, not including your breach of contract against LPA, that's $38,000 more than the district said, okay, we're only claiming $180,000 here post-revocation. And if you take and add the breach of contract damages, which counsel did add, he said LPA should be liable for $57,000. That's $66,500 more than the district had claimed was damages. And so that is clearly a certain and unequivocal statement of a factual dispute constituting a judicial admission. I'd like to save my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Brent Case. I'm counsel in this case for Whitefield School District Number 3. Now, this case involves the district's claims against Leadership Preparatory Academy, a former charter school, and two of its founders or officers, the Tylers. The district's claims are for breaching the charter school contract and for various financial improprieties committed on behalf of the Tylers, including taking money and property to which the court found that, or the court eventually found that the district was entitled, and using charter school funds to pay for Mr. Tyler's personal credit card bills. Now, this appeal is basically about the defendants incorrectly asserting that the trial court erred in instructing the jury, but the majority of their appeal is trying to convince this court to step in the shoes of the jury to make credibility determinations that were the exclusive province of the jury in that case, and that's something that this Court of Appeals cannot do. I will want to address immediately the issue that Judge Terry brought up at the beginning of opposing counsel's argument. The court ruled in the district's favor on their motion for summary judgment in the breach of contract claim. Looking at the contract specifically says that following revocation of the contract, the school district's authority includes the return of all of any assets acquired by LPA during the time of its existence. These assets, of course, as Judge Jones noted, included all the money that LPA had in its bank accounts. The court made this determination on summary judgment, and that is as the court found as a matter of law that the district, upon revocation, was entitled to each and every one of LPA's assets. So, in terms of conversion, the appellants are arguing that that the district didn't show the requisite intent for a conversion claim, and that's just not true. In their briefs, they invoke a case called Bornman, which is a criminal case discussing what's required in a jury instruction in a criminal theft charge. The court in that case specifically required a knowledge component. That case law is not applicable to a civil conversion claim. There's obviously a higher or a standard of mens rea in a criminal case that's not applicable in the conversion, civil conversion arena. Appellants haven't cited any authority to say that such an instruction is appropriate or much less required in a conversion case. In any event, it's not reversible error for the trial court to refuse an instruction, the instruction that the appellants are claiming should have been given, if the instructions ultimately given encompass the basic content of that instruction. In this case, the jury was instructed, and we must presume that the jury followed those instructions, to consider whether the Tylers intentionally exercised dominion or control over the district's property, and instructed them to consider their intent to assert a right inconsistent with the district's right of control and their good faith. This all includes this basic knowledge component that the appellants are claiming should have been.
Excuse me a moment. I want to ask about the knowledge component. Did the Tylers request a jury instruction on that included a knowledge requirement?
Yes. They did.
Did they object to the instruction that was given on the basis that it did not include a knowledge requirement? Did they object to on that basis at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. They specifically did in the on the record after the instructions conference. Their objection was that the knowledge component of Bornman should have been specifically included in the conversion instruction. Another point of confusion about LPA's assets is this issue of the court's determination on summary judgment of the breach of contract claim is separate and apart from the court's preliminary injunction order that was issued beforehand. So while the preliminary injunction may have been ambiguous about whether or not the money in the accounts had to be turned over to the district, it seems to specifically hold that that money was to be frozen, and in fact that's what happened. But the determination that all of LPA's assets belong to the district following revocation, once the school district asked for them, was made on summary judgment later, after the court had issued its order on preliminary injunction. The contract on assets simply speaks for itself, and there is no this argument that conversion isn't. That there would be no conversion claim where there was a legal dispute as to whether the school district was entitled to the property. That dispute was settled. That was settled before trial on summary judgment. As a matter of law, that property did belong to the school district. In terms of punitive damages here, counsel, again, argues that there wasn't any evidence of willful and wanton conduct. However, the evidence in the record belies that conclusion. Speaking back to the preliminary injunction, the court ordered the Tylers and LPA to turn over assets, and the Tylers never did that. Deliberate disregard of a court order. The Tylers were later found in contempt, and that's in the record. That's evidence of willful and wanton conduct that justifies punitive damages, and there's case law on that point.
Mr. Case, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about the damages. First, could you address opposing counsel's assertion that by saying we're not claiming the $50,000, that was a judicial admission?
Yes, Your Honor, that wasn't a judicial admission. When you look at the case law on, when you look at the exact statement that trial counsel made in closing argument, the statement was not near as cut and dry as appellants presented it to you. It included words that were fraught with uncertainty.
Well, how about where he says, so $50,000 of that we're not claiming? That doesn't seem very uncertain.
Well, Your Honor, when read in context, I believe it is, because shortly before that, counsel at length goes on to say that the damages in this case were difficult to decide. They weren't cast in stone. They were uncertain, and that the district thought that various defendants were liable for certain damages.
Yeah, but right after that, he subtracts the $50,000 from the 220 and says that leaves about 180 after making some other adjustments.
Well, Your Honor, counsel's statement in closing argument was simply a version of the facts that were in dispute and a recommendation to how the jury could interpret the evidence concerning those facts.
So when counsel says we're not claiming this, the jury isn't supposed to hold them to that?
Well, correct. When read in context, Your Honor, the jury here was presented with the evidence of post-revocation payments and heard the testimony from both sides on which payments were appropriate and which payments aren't appropriate. And in the substance of the closing argument is that damages are difficult to decide. Here's one way of looking at them. This, we're not claiming that money that, you know, that's taken from, when you look at that statement in context, it's clear that that opposing counsel or that a counsel viewed that as an uncertain and just one way of looking at it. And in the cases cited in our answer brief, it's clear that in under a similar circumstance, that was held not to be a judicial admission.
I have one more question regarding
sure.
the damages, and that is the assertion by opposing counsel that as to the $36,000, that came out of money, the per pupil revenue that would have been spent anyway by the school. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, my response to that is the $90,000 per pupil revenue payment. This is money that the school district was already entitled to by virtue of following the revocation of the contract. So this is not like LPA's paying the school district that money. Once the school district revoked the contract, this PPR payment that was scheduled to go to LPA became the property of the school district. And the school district, even had it paid that to LPA, would have been entitled to that money in any event. That's separate and apart from the $36,000 that the school district had to spend because it was denied access by LPA to 660 Syracuse, the school building, and all the materials in it.
Let's back up before you get into that. This $90,000, all right, it becomes the property of the district, but those students go elsewhere. They go to other schools, so presumably then the district would have to distribute that per pupil revenue to those other schools to account for those new students.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the students who are going to LPA went to a school, the Whitefield School of Choice, which was a school district school that the district scrambled to come up with to have some place to put these students since LPA wasn't going to be in business the following year. So that this $90,000 was the district's money, and the district was able to spend it to continue the educational programs of that school. If LPA would have complied with the contract, and turned over its assets to the school district upon demand, the school district wouldn't have had to spend the $36,000, and it would have had the $90,000 in hand anyway. In other words, the school district's getting the $90,000 back no matter what. And if LPA had complied with the contract, it wouldn't have spent the $36,000. So the school district was out $36,000. I mean, that's it doesn't matter what happens to this PPR payment. That was the school the school district was entitled to those funds, and that didn't obviate the need to spend the $36,000. As far as the money had and received claim, the Tylers again argue that they lacked the requisite intent, or the requisite intent wasn't shown at trial to prove this claim. However, that's not an element of a money had and received claim. You know, the elements of a money had and received claim are if there is money that in equity and good conscience the defendant should return to the plaintiff. Well, the jury could have determined, based on the evidence shown to it, that this nearly 95, or well, the jury found 95, but this $110,000 that was paid to pay off Mr. Tyler's American Express card from school district funds should, in equity and good conscience, have been paid back to the school district. Same thing with the post-revocation payments that were effectuated by the Tylers following revocation of the contract. Another issue that the appellants present is the fact that they assert that the damages were based on speculation. Well, in what happened in the trial in this case is that the jury was presented with a summary of the bills, and the school district witness Joe Royer stood before the jury and testified to what he thought was appropriate and inappropriate. Kimberly Tyler James, a defendant and a witness for LPA, got up and did the same thing. Ms. Tyler James, in her testimony, admitted that close to $70,000 of that money was inappropriate, that there was no legitimate school expense for that. Mr. Royer disagreed and said his number was closer to $110,000. And the jury looked or heard the testimony of those two witnesses and made a decision as to what it thought when it was presented with the bills for what was appropriate and what was inappropriate, the $95,000 was in fact inappropriate and should, in equity and good conscience, be returned to the school district. This whole notion of Mr. Tyler's lack of intent also with the conversion claim is belied, of course, by the contempt of court order, also by his testimony at trial that he was moved the money out of the school district accounts because he knew that he moved the money out of the LPA accounts because he knew that the school district was coming for it. Now, the appellants complain about my citation of that testimony in the record because immediately after that, Mr. Tyler inexplicably testifies that, well, I wasn't doing that to keep it away from the district. But of course he was. I mean, we have evidence that the school district, we have the evidence that the contract entitled the school district to every one of LPA's assets following revocation. We have evidence that the school district demanded it turn over all assets, including the bank accounts. And Mr. Tyler's testimony that he knew that the district's next step was to go and take control of the money in the LPA bank accounts, so he took it with a series of and made it into a series of cashier's checks, which he then split into a more series of cashier's checks. And there was evidence at trial that that is a means of disguising money. With that, Your Honor, my time's expired.
First, there was no demand made for the bank accounts. There was a demand made, but it was for access to the accounts and for return of the personal property. Second, the damages on the American Express, it was $146,000 that was on the American Express, and the $90,000 difference included or did not include the $60,000 or $70,000 that Mrs. Tyler James had admitted was inappropriate. In addition, there was a $55,000 payment by Mr. Tyler for those inappropriate charges. Second, the civil rights claims were pre-revocation, and this was their affirmative defense to the breach of contract. And also, in addition to the breach of contract, at the time of the breach of contract motion was in 2005. The payments were made to third parties in 2004 following the revocation and prior to the State Board of Education decision. And lastly, the $90,000 PPR money was payment that was taken without notice. And so it was $36,000 that was used from that $90,000 PPR.
Council, I have one question before you sit down. On your judicial admission argument.
Yes.
Opposing counsel stated that Mr. Royer testified that 48,419 of that would have been spent anyway. We're not claiming that money, so $50,000 of that we're not claiming.
Correct.
Do you contend that the judicial admission is for $50,000 or for 48,419?
The judicial admission is for the $50,000.
That's not a shorthand for the 48,000.
I think it is a shorthand. I mean, 48,419, we're talking $1,500 difference. So I think it is a shorthand for the 48,419.
So that really is the number that you seek to have this damage award deducted.
Though to the 180, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Court thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the argument here.